You can't separate your Christianity from reality. Now, we live in a nation where we happen to be the government. This is a unique situation in that, as Lincoln said long ago, it's the government of the people, by the people, for the people. And so really, you can't help but be a part of the political process to one degree or another merely by your citizenship. As far as being active politically, brethren, we have to understand that we're dealing here with moral issues and matters of fundamental biblical truth. And we're not advocating that we ought to use the pulpit to campaign for a party or for a candidate. And in fact, you lose your tax-exempt status if you do that. But there is right now, but I tell you what, if they're going to muzzle us completely, I'd rather pay taxes and speak the truth than worry about the money. Dub rather go to jail, not me. But, you know, there are limits to my conviction, but no. But while we can't outrightly campaign in that way, there's no reason we can't be informed. You know, I've had brethren act like if the Apostle Paul were running for president against Adolf Hitler, that you couldn't tell brethren who to vote for. Or that if you told them they couldn't vote for one or the other, that as though it were an utterly, morally indifferent situation. I know it's much more complex than that. But as far as mixing politics and the pulpit, when I just finished, I asked Dub, I said, was that a little bit too politicized? And in fact, he said yes, and he took my check away from me that I had. But it was a little heavy-handed, I confess. I tried to be balanced, brethren, and say that we need to deal with things on a case-by-case basis. When it comes to brethren who object to politics in the pulpit, I think we need to point out that we need to make a distinction between addressing moral issues and the fact that they are a part of the political realm and that we can have an influence on the political process, and merely party fidelity, where we simply line up with a party or we're dealing with peripheral issues like prescription drug benefits or welfare reform, even though there is clearly a biblical morality and a proper biblical position even on those things. There is a distinction to be made before when it comes to these crucial moral issues of the day. And I think the reason I preached this sermon in one place, and I was supposed to go there, that it was a Wednesday, that following Sunday, to fill in for their preacher who was out of the country on mission work. And after I preached this sermon, a few brethren of a particular political persuasion bawled and squalled about it. In fact, one of the objections they made is that the picture of Clinton wasn't as flattering as the picture of Bush. Look, I'm not claiming to be fair and balanced. I wasn't trying to be. I was trying to simply speak the truth, but a few people squalled about it, and I got uninvited from coming back that following Sunday. And the elders got up, made a statement to try to appease people on both sides of it. I know it really stirs some brethren up, and I know we need to bear with some brethren who are ignorant, some willfully, some not, who don't understand the differences in the parties are not so much what they were years ago, but they're now more and more along moral lines. Along these crucial social issues. It's not the same when we were debating the New Deal, even though, again, there's another area where you'd have a definite biblical position when it comes to welfare and public assistance. But since that time, we're dealing with crucial life and death issues that affect whether God's wrath is going to come upon our nation or whether we can be the salt and the light that will help the nation to long endure so that people can still enjoy the freedoms and privileges that we have to proclaim the gospel and take it here and abroad. There's a lot at stake here, brethren. We need to understand that we can utilize the political process to bring about good. Now, we don't put our ultimate trust in the government. That's a monumental error, and that's a misrepresentation of what I'm saying if anybody says that. Our trust is in the power of the gospel to change men's hearts. But why shouldn't we, brethren, use the freedom which many good men and women died to give us to influence the political process for the sake of upholding biblical morality? I can't understand why anybody would be opposed to that. And in order to do that, you have to be informed to some extent. And how you become informed, exactly to what degree, and how we handle that, we may vary in our own judgment on that matter. But it is incorrect to say in an absolute way that there's no place for politics at all in the pulpit. We do need to make distinctions, I think. And we do need to bear with brethren who have been conditioned to think that you can never speak in the way that we have about these kinds of issues and not be unnecessarily divisive. But at the same time, we need some elders in the church who have backbone to stand up for what is right, even if it's going to offend some of their political cronies in the congregation.
It's Brother Young. I'm Ron Burton from San Antonio, and a member of the church congregation. A while ago, you had on the screen there a man that was violently trying to terminate the pregnancy, I guess, of his girlfriend. And while you've alluded to the discussion of mothers' rights, what about the other side of the coin, the rights of the father, those who wish to intervene on behalf of the life of the child as a father? Do you have any information regarding that aspect?
Well, we briefly touched on the fact that those who label themselves as pro-choice are actually anti-choice when it comes to paternal, the rights of the father to decide whether the child lives or dies. Now, while to state the obvious, there is a special relationship between the baby and the mother. The baby is no less the father's than the mother's. And so the father should have a say, obviously, in the protection of that life in the womb. But there's a limit to what he can do, especially because of the law. You know, he can't stop his wife from taking drugs and from doing drinking alcohol and doing things that would be harmful to his baby. He can't physically, chain her up and isolate her so that nothing happens to her that would be detrimental to the health of the child. And unfortunately, he cannot step in. The way it ought to be is abortion on demand should not be legal, period. But even with the claim that abortion on demand can be legal, abortion should not be allowed without the father of that child to sign on as well. You see, I'm not advocating that we allow abortions just as long as mom and dad agree. But I'm just simply saying, given the context in which we're living with abortion legalized, it shouldn't be permitted without the consent of the mother of the child or the consent of the father. But all this talk about concern for rights and choice is all exposed as the lie that it is, because there's no concern about the rights of that father.
And what about the DNA testing that goes on to discover whether the said person is the father of said child?
Well, I guess you'd have to settle that, given the rampant promiscuity and the fact that a woman can simply deny that an individual is the father of her child. That would have to come into play as well. But clearly, paternal rights should be on the table in the abortion discussion, and they're not. And think of all the fathers who've had their children murdered. But now, we should point this out as well, though. There are many women who choose abortion because they're abandoned by the fathers of their children, because those fathers are not willing to accept the consequences of their illicit sexual behavior. Really, to oppose abortion fundamentally, we need to go behind it and uphold God's the biblical ethic of sexual morality, because abortions, the vast majority of abortions by far, are from women who are in crisis pregnancies or who are not married. And you get pregnant not being married by committing fornication. Are we all together on this? We understand what we're talking about here. So we need to go back into upholding to our young people the ethic of biblical sexuality, God's plan for sex, and start with our young people. And thankfully, there has been a slight decline in the number of abortions in recent years, due in part to the fact that more teenagers are remaining chaste than years ago. So there is slight improvement there, but when you compare the numbers now with the numbers 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they're just awful. They're ghastly. But thankfully, over the last few years, there's been a slight decline in teenage pregnancy and a corresponding decline in abortion. So these are linked. These issues are linked. 10.
Ted Clark from Mammoth Spring, Arkansas. This may be beyond the scope of your research, but I'm curious if you did any work on determining the relationship of abortion to euthanasia in those countries where that's legal now. Was abortion a precursor to that? And what do you think that has led to, and in which direction are we headed here in this country, do you think?
Well, these obviously are related. It has to do with the biblical ethic of the value of human life. And I don't have, unfortunately, I don't have at my fingertips or at my disposal at this moment the figures that would verify a correspondence between the disregard for human life in the womb with the disregard for human life in old age. But we know certainly in ancient history, like in cultures that disregarded the life, for example, where females were simply left, you know, the male children were the desired children, and if a woman had a little girl, sometimes they were simply abandoned to die. And in those cultures, like in ancient Rome, where that was done, we know that there was also a disregard for the infirmed and the aged. It was the spread of Christian principle throughout the empire and then gradually the world that led to a respect for human life at both ends of the spectrum, that led to hospitals and institutions that care for orphans and the aged and the infirm. Now, we need look no further than our own nation. What have we seen in the news recently? What is all the controversy over Terry, is it Schiavo? Am I saying that correctly? Terry Schiavo, her husband, wanted to remove her feeding tube. 13 years she was in what he's claiming was a persistent vegetative state. And the parents of Terry wanted to block that, and the court wouldn't let him. So here you have it's not just the aged, but the infirmed as well. Someone who is incapacitated like Terry Schiavo. If we can dispose of life because it's inconvenient, here she was. She had been granted a $13 million lawsuit because of her injuries that resulted from surgery and that resulted in her vegetative state. And I heard that the medical bills are eating all that up, and he wants to hurry up and get rid of her so he can have the money and marry his sweetie with whom he's already had a child. Now, I can't judge the man's heart, but that's what the parents are claiming. But if you can dispose of the child in the womb because it's inconvenient, how can we turn around and then consistently say, you can't dispose of your infirmed wife because she's inconvenient? There is a connection, clearly, purely philosophically you can see it. Once you disregard human life, once hedonism becomes the rule that I should be permitted to do whatever brings me pleasure, the radical individualism behind hedonism, that I should be unrestrained in my personal pursuit of pleasure, then no human life is safe. In the embryonic stage, we're seeing that with stem cell research and human cloning. This is tied as well. The respect for life, the disrespect for human life, is tied as well to all the discussion about stem cell research and human cloning. Here you have a situation where human beings are being experimented on at the embryonic stage and destroyed for the possible benefit of a few other people. And so we have created what has been called a culture of death. We're already well down the slippery slope, We've already stepped off, and we are plummeting toward the legalization of euthanasia, as you have in a limited way, I believe, in the state of Oregon. Physician-assisted suicide was first legalized in Oregon, correct? Or is it Washington? Someone help me. It's Oregon, isn't it? And I recently did some research this for a lesson on euthanasia that I give in a series. I do a series of lectures on social issues, and we start with the homosexual agenda, we deal with abortion, we deal with pornography, and then we finally go to euthanasia. So I don't have the figures, I don't have the social science research to verify it, but we know, of course, that once life is disrespect, once there's no respect for human life, once we devalue human life because it's inconvenient in the womb, then there's no reason to respect human life in any situation. And with the increase in the demographics right now, the largest growing, the fastest growing segment of the population are the aged. Those who are over 60. And soon, we're going to be addressing you young people. It's not going to be long before you're going to be having to face crucial moral issues. We're going to be addressing what to do with all these people when Social Security is bankrupt and they're languishing in nursing homes and hospital beds, when it's going to be a lot easier just to say, well, let's just call in Dr. Jack Kevorkian here. And great-grandma's had a nice life. And, you know, I know she's still with us, but she's inconvenient and she's draining our bank account. And it's simply another step down that slippery slope. So thank you for raising the point of the connection between abortion and euthanasia and the destruction of life in the stem cell research and in human cloning. It really comes down to who is going to be God. Are we going to be God and destroy human life and dispose of it at will for our own convenience? Or are we going to respect God and let Him, as the author and creator of life, dictate under what circumstances we have a right to take human life?
Ken Chumley from Belvidere, South Carolina. I'm neither a Democrat or
Republican.
Wait a minute,
is that a South Carolina accent I hear there?
No. I'm neither a Democrat nor a Republican. I'm a Tory.
But wow.
Seriously, to address what you were dealing with just a moment ago with euthanasia. A number of years ago when I was in England, I attended a seminar in connection with this. In Holland, not only do they have legalized abortion, they have legalized euthanasia and have done so for many years. The medical society is split, that they have two medical societies, those that will perform such and those that won't.
The physician-assisted suicide,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. And what we have got to recognize is these things are clearly in our future unless we change some directions. And I may not get the statement correct, but the only thing that takes evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. We're in a status where we have got to take a stand. And when we're dealing with matters of abortion and euthanasia and homosexuality and all these other things, the question was raised with respect to preaching these things. In my opinion, I believe that's part of preaching the gospel, because these are biblical issues. And we're in a situation now, as we see it in the north of the border, with the legalization of homosexual marriage and the idea now that's being propagated that for those to speak against homosexuality, even from a biblical perspective, is going to be outlawed. We may not only lose our tax-exempt status, but we may find ourselves, yes, going to the jailhouse. But we have a right, we have an obligation to speak out against these abominations to God. And sometimes it may mean stepping on some sensitive toes. But what is more important? The sensitive toes of our brethren, or the tiny toes that we saw in that picture a little while ago?
Well said. We do need to think, could we have ever imagined even 15 years ago that we would be where we are now with the push to legalize same-sex marriage. Well, I think 15 years ago we could have imagined it, given the trends that were well in place. But just a granddad and grandma a generation ago, could they imagine we'd be talking about legalization of homosexual marriage, as has already been done in Canada? And it's on the way, brethren. I'd like to see you preach on these things and steer completely away from any type of political statement at all. You know, if you do, you're just going to be getting up and offering the brethren a bunch of fluff. I mean, you might be able to preach on it and just talk about it in a general way and keep getting your paycheck and pat yourself on your spineless back and go home at night and wake up again the next day and somehow look at yourself in the mirror. Not me. By the way, I'm in need of a paycheck, if anyone...
Johnny McCarron, Christoval, Texas. Just had a comment in regards to some things been discussing. Marlon Maddox wrote a book a few years ago called The Seal of Gaia, in which he looked at a lot of the New Age thinking, and it had a lot of denominational dogmas and so forth in it. But, of course, it's fiction, and he was looking forward to about 2025, something like that, and taking some of the things that we're doing in America to their logical conclusions. And in that book, he depicted that the age at which you could choose whether you were going to keep your child or not had been moved to 3 years. And so up until their third birthday, you could decide if you wanted to take that child's life or keep them. And he depicted a kind of a clinic, I guess you'd call it, in the mall that you took your child, and they had clowns there and coloring books and all of that for the child, you know, and then they took them back and gave them this injection. Really makes us think.
Well,
and as you talk about, you know, the stance that we have to take, these things aren't going to stop. If we don't take a stance, they're not going to stop where they are.
Right.
They will keep moving forward and into the euthanasia and all of those things.
We've already gone beyond abortion in the womb. And really, I don't see how the court, some are optimistic. President Bush said in his speech that his legal team and many others would work very hard to defend this law, this ban on partial birth abortion in the courts. But really, it's irrational to say that there's no basis, scientific or otherwise, to say that we can't, first to say that we had legalized partial birth abortion. It's all right to kill the baby as long as the head is in the birth canal. But if the head comes out, we have to keep the baby alive. If the head's in the birth canal, then we can kill it. All right, now we're going to ban that. So now we're going to say, well, you can still kill the baby in the womb as long as all of it is still up in the birth canal. On what rational basis can you say, you can kill that baby in the womb, but just not if some of the limbs are protruding from the birth canal? I don't see any legal justification for it, given the direction the court has already taken. The only way they could legally justify it is to overturn Roe v. Wade. And that's where we've got to look long-term, to changing men's hearts through the gospel and transforming the culture through the power of Christ in our lives, to raise up a generation that will put in place those who will overturn Roe versus Wade and stop the slaughter of the innocents. But what I wanted to say is, you mentioned the killing of children until they're 3 years old. Peter Singer, who is professor of bioethics at Princeton, which was, you know, of course, one of the greatest of so-called Christian universities in our history, and he is, of all things, professor of bioethics at Princeton, and so he holds a position of great notoriety and prestige, and he has advocated that parents be allowed until, I believe, up to 14 days or 21 days after birth to decide whether the child should live or die, based on whether or not it shows the child shows any deformities or is limited some way in some capacity, and up to 21 days. Now, how you arrive at that figure, why 21's okay and not 22, why 1-year-old or 3-year-old makes any difference? You know, who's next, brethren? Shall only the beautiful and the intelligent live? I mean, there goes Dub right there. I mean, you think about it. But shall I mean, then we start talking about the mentally challenged, the physically challenged. Shall only those that we deem to be in a fit mental and physical state, who can be of some value or use to us, be deemed to live? We ought to shudder at what is happening, and it was predicted. He was right. Kevin was next.
Kevin Townsend here from San Antonio. I was hoping to ask you a really tough question, and if you answered it, Doug would pay you, but after that last comment, I don't think you're going to get any money.
All
right. You'll probably have to walk home. Actually, I have a very serious question. It was posed to me in a discussion. Now, you'd made the comment earlier that this in the birth canal, out of the birth canal, the timeline, what's the difference between a baby who's in the womb and out of the womb? And the question that was posed to me had to do with defense of the unborn. And the query was put this way. If you see your neighbor's child about to be killed by an aggressor, you have every legal and moral right to use deadly force to defend this individual. Mm-hmm. And his point to me was, what's the difference if it is a human life and it's in the womb, and if I can use deadly force to defend my neighbor's kid playing in the front yard against a person with a gun or a knife, why can't I use the same deadly force to prevent the murder of a child then? Now, of course, I dealt with the question where Jesus said, you know, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight. But I'm a little, you know, I was ill-equipped to answer that, and I thought maybe you could comment.
Well, it comes to the question of civil disobedience. Now, I'd never thought as far as actually taking the life of it. If you look here in the slide, that's about where I was going to go next. Paul Hill was just executed in Florida, the first man executed for murdering an abortion clinic doctor and his assistant outside of his abortion clinic. And he was heralded by some in the pro-life movement as a martyr for the cause, protecting unborn lives. What he did was set back the pro-life movement. And those who thinking rationally actually condemned his act, and we appreciate those who are leaders in defending the lives of unborn children in condemning what he did, and he should have been executed for what he did. But this is a complicated issue that I'll just briefly try to summarize. As far as civil disobedience goes, you look in the scripture when Pharaoh commanded that the male children be thrown into the river, the Hebrew midwives did not submit to the law of the land to protect innocent life. And you have other examples like that as well in scripture. But it's another thing to take it upon ourselves to take human life without authority. I don't think they're parallel cases when you say, well, here's a man who's beating a child to death over here. Can I use deadly force to save that child's life? And you have the complication of the fact that the unborn child is still an entity inside of another person. And so it is not altogether parallel with any situation you can envision happening to a child. But what I would say is, you know, those who want to form human chains in front of abortion clinics and actually block access, they only set back the effort to save unborn lives. You can make a case for civil disobedience, but we need to be discerning. What is the wisest thing to do? How can we have the biggest impact? You might kill an abortion doctor. Have you saved any babies? Have you saved any baby? You think that woman is not going to have an abortion? Perhaps one or two. Maybe a woman at the last minute might change her mind who was scheduled for an appointment that day and doesn't get the abortion. But we need to think long term. What we've got to do is change people's hearts and work as leaven in the culture and actively through the political process to change things long term. Like, look at how many people worked so hard in the progress that was made just to ban partial birth abortion, to get that law signed. It took tremendous amounts of lobbying, funding, and conviction and commitment and work. That is all set back when someone takes a gun in hand and goes into an abortion clinic and kills an abortion doctor, because then the media parades those who would be pro-life as being radical Christian right, motivated by a dangerous philosophy, and it only in the public image, it actually, I think, results in more children being destroyed. So we've got to think a little bit more deeply about the complications of it. We want to save as many lives as possible, and going right now to an abortion clinic and blowing it up is only going to further the abortion cause. You know, they're going to be able to raise more money to promote abortion from that clinic bombing. They send out their letters then to all their supporters. Look what the pro-life people are doing. It's time to rally and, you know, defend abortion more than ever before. And you actually help the slaughter of babies when you pursue that course. So we need a little more wisdom to it. Whether it's ethical would, I guess, depend on how radical a step you're taking. But whether it's wise, no. No, let's change people's hearts and change the culture through the gospel. Ultimately, that's the long-term goal.
Gary Summers, Winter Park, Florida. Just to comment on that, people all agree in the use of deadly force for the neighbor's child. They don't all agree on the other. That's one thing that makes it different, even though it's an attempt to make it parallel.
I'm afraid not even all of our brethren would agree on using deadly force to save your neighbor's child, unfortunately.
That's a different issue.
Right. That's the 5 o'clock hour.
The only comment I wanted to make, and some will probably remember, in fact, far better than I do, the first presidential election I remember is Adlai Stevenson against Dwight D. Eisenhower. I don't remember any moral issue being part of that campaign. In 1960, when Kennedy and Nixon faced off, there was a question about Kennedy's Catholicism, but I don't remember any moral issue. In 1964... I don't remember any moral issue with Goldwater and Johnson or with Nixon in 68 or 72. Sometime between then and about 1980, after Roe versus Wade in 1973, that became an issue. And then not too long after that, homosexuality also became an issue. I don't remember moral issues being involved up till then. There may have been. Of course, the Vietnam War was considered a moral issue.
But they weren't at the forefront.
And it is the morality that has been thrust upon the politics,
right,
not the other way around. So we have a choice that didn't exist. It was Republican versus Democrat. Some are one, some are the other. Who knows why? Tradition, whatever. But there was not because of moral issues that I'm aware of. Now, someone else may want to correct that.
Well, this,
but now we have, as you pointed out, a great deal of funding from pornographers, from the homosexual group, and from the abortion crowd. And they might support anyone in either party, but as a party, they support one over the other. And we ought to ask ourselves, why is that? And am I going to support somebody who's going to endorse homosexuality, abortion, pornography, and not do anything about it? That's the point.
And, you know, that was the first presidential election he can remember. It reminded me, Ted, weren't you at the Lincoln-Douglas debates? you know, how brethren can go and sit in the assembly of the saints or study with someone or talk to their neighbors and oppose the homosexual agenda and act outraged by it, and decry the slaughter of children through abortion on demand, and then go into the voting booth and pull a lever down to put a candidate in office who is going to be beholden to activists who are promoting those very things is beyond me. But what happened historically, we don't have time to go into it, is you had a secularization of one of the two major political parties. And with their platform welcoming more and more radical groups, by default, the religious conservatives went to the other party. That's exactly what happened in the 70s. In fact, in the 80s, it was the demarcation where you had the party, the secularization of their platform, and you had then this marked movement of the rest who wanted to stand for traditional values moving by default to the other party. And so there has been an alignment that has happened in the last 20 years that we need to consider and take a look at. And Dub said we just got a couple more minutes, so I just wanted to suggest, you know, we talk about what we can do. Ken, You said we've got to do something, and it's one thing to get up in an assembly like this and just decry abortion and lambast those who promote it. But we need to be doing something about this. And brethren, we first of all need to pray. Pray daily for the unborn. Pray that we would have judges who would respect life, who would fear God and judge righteous judgment, and that we can turn men's hearts to God. And pray that we'd have leadership raised up in the church that understands the times. Men with backbone and conviction who know that we need to reprove the unfruitful works of darkness. We have in so many places leadership in the church that is weak as dishwater and that is just either indifferent toward this or squelching any effort that brethren want to make to be active in this area. We've got to remain balanced, true. But brethren, let's pray earnestly for leadership in the church and for our hearts to be stirred up to be able to create a culture of life and a respect for life. That means we need to inform people. We mentioned earlier, even the mainstream media is talking about how this new science is changing the debate, changing people's minds. We should be out in the forefront. I think our congregation should be getting together and taking out full-page ads on a regular basis in major newspapers, putting commercials on television, talking about the sanctity of human life in the womb and that the Bible declares that life to be human and protected. We ought to be informing people through every means possible. We've already talked about this, and so I won't go through this. We talked about using the political process. How this works, of course, is we elect those who will be in the White House, those who will be in the Congress, and then the president will appoint to the Supreme Court men for life who will make decisions as to whether millions of children live or die. And those appointments must be first confirmed by those whom we elect to the Senate. And thankfully, in the great state of Texas, we have a couple of senators who are friends of unborn children. And I believe Jim Cornyn's a member of the church. I don't know that for sure, but someone told me that. But that has helped. But you know, right now, and this is simply the fact of the matter, the Democrats are filibustering President Bush's pro-life appointees to the federal courts. They don't want conservative judges on our courts who respect life. And so much so did they block a vote coming up for Miguel Estrada, and their actions have been unconstitutional, contrary to the letter and spirit of the Constitution. But Miguel Estrada finally withdrew his name from consideration. And here's a picture of Tom Daschle and the Democrats celebrating Miguel Estrada's withdrawal from consideration for the federal court. Oh, there's a great day coming, though, when the people won't be celebrating anymore. And we need to pray as well, brethren, for the enemies of the gospel who are promoting a culture of death to repent. And we need to pray that they won't prevail in their wickedness and take comfort in the fact that God will judge and Christ will come and He will pour out His wrath on those who are enemies to His people. But let me add this. We need to assist women in practical terms in crisis pregnancies. I know we need to finish, but I at least wanted to get this in that, you know, the denominational groups are way ahead of us as far as the pregnancy centers that have been established in many places that have had a major impact in providing an alternative to abortion, where women can go and get counseling and assistance so that they don't feel like abortion is their only option. These people in these pregnancy centers, motivated by the love of Christ,